Welcome to the Review of Democracy, the journal of the CEU Democracy Institute, where we discuss some of the most exciting new ideas concerning the past, present, and future of democracies across the globe. I am Ferenc Lotzó. I co-head the ideas section at RevDem, and it is my very special pleasure to be hosting Jacob Michanowski today. Welcome to the show, Jacob, and thanks so much for joining.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Great to have you at the Review of Democracy. By way of an all too brief introduction, Jacob Michanowski is a writer, journalist, and critic based in Portland, who has a PhD in European history from the University of California, Berkeley. He has written for places like The Atlantic or The New York Times, among a host of other publications. And he has just released a fascinating new book titled Goodbye, Eastern Europe, An Intimate History of a Divided Land, which offers a highly original general history of Eastern Europe and focuses primarily on questions of culture, politics, religion, and ideology. It is a book that I have read with great pleasure, and I'm thrilled to have the chance to discuss some of the themes in this major book with its author today. So now you state in your prologue, Jacob, that you are inclined to view Eastern Europe as a place where various systems of belief have interacted, competed, and may have become hybridized. You seem to be interested in a collection of shared affinities structured around a shared memory of coexistence and in exploring what might make Eastern Europe a civilization of its own. So how would you compare your approach to those of previous authors who have written more extensively about the history of this diverse region? And what would you highlight when it comes to the special features, the eigenart of Eastern Europe?
That's a great question. I think the big difference in what in my approach versus most other approaches of people who take a wide angle, big picture lens, is that I focus more on social structures and beliefs and societies rather than politics, than nations and states. It's much more the interaction of people under the level of government, at the level of town, village, belief, custom that interests me, rather than I think most histories approach, you know, go top down, which makes sense, and look at political systems, either, and the structuring narrative is one of nationalisms turning into nations. That's my grad advisor and great friend John Conley, peoples into nations. That's one narrative, and that's the Joseph Rothschild narrative. Another one is totalitarianism and the imposition of rule from outside by the Soviet Union, by Nazi Germany. That's the kind of the Snyder-Applebaum take. And then, you know, the persistence of small states, of the medieval kingdoms of Hungary and Poland and Bohemia, kind of the Halecki, Bibo, small, you know, medieval roots and into the present and the fragility of the East Central European state. And I'm much less interested in states. I'm much more interested in peoples, customs, and that interaction that happens at a more intimate, like the title says, level. And that comes partly from my own background as from a Polish Jewish family and a mixed Polish Jewish family. The Polish part is also mixed with Hungarian, Lithuanian, German, Czech roots in there. But that interaction that happens at the level of the family, the level of the village, the level of customs, what interests me. And so that individuality for me, the region is, you know, you can define it, its individuality in different ways. You can look at it, as a lot of those writers do, as an area of burgeoning nationalism, of nation states striving for empires. I'm more interested in that interaction of religion, which is also an interaction of language, is also an interaction of ethnicity, because all those things get stacked on top of each other in a unique way. And for me, the uniqueness is that multi-level social division, that there are divisions often into three or four social kind of castes in the pre-modern world, in the traditional world, in the kind of pre-1918, pre-1867, pre-1848, pre-revolutionary, pre-reform world, that in each community, you have different social functions fulfilled by people in different denominations, Christianity, and different religions, especially Judaism being an important one, but also Islam in the South, and each of those castes and religions having an associated language and ethnic dimension, so that within a very small space, within like one Ukrainian, what now Ukrainian village of 200 people, you would have Jewish merchants, Ukrainian peasants, Polish landowners, and maybe a visiting, itinerant Roma craftspeople, peddlers, all in that same space. And that I think is very uniquely, that for me is the uniqueness of Eastern Europe. And that's something you can't really find in Western Europe, definitely not to that level, not to that level of multiple stacking. And also, I don't think it quite exists in central Russia, which is more, you have caste division, but it does exist in places like Northern Mesopotamia, the Caucasus. It's not a completely unique Eastern European thing. But within the European context, within the context of greater Christendom, I think Eastern Europe, in a band that kind of runs from Estonia to Albania, has that unique social, ethnic, religious structure.
Thank you so much. That's a fascinating approach. And I think it's also a very fruitful one on the pages of this book. Now, the book consists of a prologue, an epilogue, and then 14 chapters that are divided into three sections that you respectively title Faith, Empires and Peoples, and then the 20th century. So could I ask you why you chose to have these three major subjects in the book, and how do they follow one another, whether chronologically or otherwise? And how do you see then the connections between these three large sections of the book?
This is a little bit of a puzzle because it is such a large topic. It's so many, it's about 20 modern day countries and about 1,000 years. Although I focused more on the last 300 or 400, but there's a little bit, I reach back a little bit, 1,000 years. So the question of the book like this is what to leave out and how to simplify that into a structure that gives some guideposts for the reader. This is for a more of a novice to the subject, that gives enough structure, enough narrative to guide you through, but not so much that it's overwhelming. And so I divided that way. It's a little bit unique. Faiths, I start with Eastern Europe entering written history with Christianization, with the conversion, because that's really when you go from kind of prehistory to written narrative. And you have that tradition, you have the pre-Christian paganism and whatever survivals you have of that. And then for me, Eastern Europe comes into existence through this merging of influences from outside, from different places. So the next chapter is Judaism, is Jews arriving from Western Europe, some from the East too, Karaites from the East. And then the arrival of Islam as nomadic tribes, and also the Ottoman push. And then you have that triple frontier, that triple encounter of religions, which was something that exists much more in Western Europe in the early Middle Ages, the kind of Andalusian idea, or the Jews of France, or the Jews of the Rhine. And kind of as Western Europe homogenizes, Eastern Europe becomes more diverse. And for me, that's where that cultural uniqueness comes into being. So start with that, start with those traditions. The second section, actually, I struggled to name it. I call it Empires and Peoples. I throw the idea of societies, flags. It's more about a corporate organization. So empires, Ottoman, Russian, Habsburg. And then I think too interesting, and the chapter that for me matters a lot is a chapter called Peoples, which lays out some of the thesis of the book, which is about that tries to lay out that idea of coexistence and living in very close spaces, but often quite separately socially and culturally, that characterizes the Eastern European city, the Eastern European town, Eastern European regions. So for me, that's a very interesting chapter, very hard chapter to write, maybe the hardest. And then chapter on nomads, on wanderers. And that I think this kind of a slightly accordion structure that is more thematic. One thing that you lose is strong narrative thrust. And I think that's tough for the reader. What you gain is that I was able to write a lot of space to the Roma and to other nomadic groups like the Aromanians, who, because they're stateless, because they don't have a lot of archives, they don't have arms, they don't have states, they fall out with more political histories. And so I like that this structure, although you kind of lose like a strong narrative thread, you do gain the ability to focus in on these minority groups. And then nations is the story of nationalism. So that central section kind of runs from the late Middle Ages to about World War I. And then the last section it switches to much more narrative history, which is 20th century and the large events and really structures that create a shared sequence of experiences across Eastern Europe, the sequence of wars, of World War I and World War II, of Stalinism and state socialism and the transition out of state socialism, and that challenging story about the inner war years which is a kind of grab bag of instability and striving for some kind of politics outside, some sort of new sacral politics, whether that's communism or fascism or something in between that struggle of the 20s and 30s. So they become, but then that last section becomes much more of a progressive narrative history from the teens to the 90s, to the early 21st century.
Great. You know, I would say that Goodbye Eastern Europe is an inspiring and original and a somewhat unusual general history of Eastern Europe for a broader public. You employ scholarly arguments, and the book contains numerous cultural and literary references. You also draw in various places on your own family history and on your travels across this region in recent years. The stories you tell are often very fascinating. They can be tragic, they can be comic, and sometimes both at the same time. So I wanted to ask you a bit about the genre of this remarkable book you have just published. You know, how would you sort of say define or describe the genre in which it is written? And because I think you have such a fine pen and you really write so well, I wanted to ask you whether there are specific writers who may have inspired the way you write, or are there perhaps writers from Eastern Europe that had a major influence on the way you try to write this book?
There are. I think it's a hybrid, you know, hybrid genre. I'm not sure how to define it, but I know what some of the influences are. You know, as a historian trained with historiography and tradition of Western European history and Eastern European history and Soviet history, late modern Europe, kind of grab bag of things. But for me, a big influence, because I was also pursuing career in journalism, and I was, I was living in Krakow in 2002, I was on a grant, and I started reading books by the Polish School of Reportage, the Polish School of Journalism. And these are a lot of very young journalists at the time, now they're a little older, working for Gazeta Wyborcza, who are writing reportage from Poland, from Russia, from Czech Republic and Hungary, and in doing it very interesting formal ways, very interesting genre ways, very interesting use of anecdote, and really writing kind of a mix of journalism and history, doing journalism that would go back to the 40s, going back to the 60s, unearthing and kind of processing a past that you couldn't write about before the 90s. And kind of the godmother of that school is a woman named Hannah Kral, who's a fantastic journalist, fantastic writer, really about the Holocaust and Jewish experience in Poland, and taught a whole generation of journalists in Poland in the Warsaw School of Journalism. So that's Mariusz Szczygieł has a great book about Czechia, Czech identity called Gotland, which was translated into English, but you know that tells the story of the Czechs through these very fascinating anecdotes and of individuals, of small stories, the story of the Stalin monument, the story of a singer who was persecuted, the Bata shoes, Krzysztof Varga, who's a Hungarian-Polish writer. So that's school, Lydia Ostałowska, was in that, Andrzej Stasiuk, who's more of a traveler, not exactly in that school, but travels in the same kind of areas. So that's for genre, I think. Also, that tragic comic sense, that comes much more from literature. I really love Eastern European literature, especially, you know, that comic part, I think, comes from Hungarian and Czech literature. Polish literature, although I love a lot of it, I think it's great poetry, is almost never funny. The journalism can be funny, but the novels aren't. But that tragic comic thing that I really love, you know, Bohumil Hrabal is a favorite writer in Hungary. In trouble with Hungarian, Bocs Kostolany and Antas Serb, who are sad but funny and find things that are absurd. And actually, historian István Rev at CU, I took a class with. I love his book. Different, not tragic comic so much, but the use of rumor, the use of modern day myth. The ideas of that rumor and myth and things that are imagined in the present in modern history are as diagnostic as kind of actual political decision-making history. You know, the history of, there's the history of the 1956 revolution, and then there's a history of what was people thought happened and what people imagined. And that level of rumor and myth and miracle, Catherine Verderi, that anthropological side of things. From the historiography, I find really inspiring the use of situation and anecdote.
Fascinating. I should say a very close Polish friend of mine gave me a book by Hannah Kral, the one about Marek Edelman, and that's one of the most incredible things I've ever read. So
she's great, and it's an amazing approach, and they're a sequence of books. That's a great interview. And then there are ones where there's shorter articles, and they're almost these like they almost read like folk tales, but they're drawn out of reportage. And I love that approach. So that was very inspiring when I really discovered her in my 20s.
Fascinating. I also thought your writing is at times a bit like Danilo Kishi's, but maybe that's
another
far.
One. No, absolutely. I should have mentioned it. Bruno Schulz. I'm actually named after Bruno Schulz.
Wow.
My real first name is Bruno. I use my middle name. Although my first name was supposed to be my middle name. So Bruno Schulz and Danilo Kishi was so inspired by Bruno Schulz. He has that jeweler's eye for the strange story for this. So I love that too. And that kind of Borges, that kind of, you know, things taken to a level of extremity that's sort of absurd. So he's wonderful. And another kind of, the half-Jewish writers of Eastern Europe have this interest in the local and interest in the universal, I find really interesting. So he's absolutely in there.
Fantastic. Now, there were several sentences in the book when I thought, okay, this could have come directly from his pen, actually. So I think you're really very close in certain moments, right? Of course, you I think do a lot of different things on these pages, but that's, I think, an important part of it as well. Now, another thing that really fascinated me about this book is that even for those who know the sheer diversity of Eastern Europe quite well, would hear about a lot of things they probably have never heard about. You traveled extensively, and you also went to places that I think are very unknown these days. You visit pagan groves, you visit shattered cathedrals to look at them more closely. You go to abandoned shrines of different kinds. You go to overgrown caravan trails and so on, right? And you've done these travels in fairly recent years. So I wanted to ask you a bit about that, you know, how having seen all these places, also abandoned places, forgotten places and so on, how that has shaped your perspective on Eastern Europe and what realization have the discovery of little known and much forgotten places then allowed you to make? And then maybe more generally, and this is something again that is particularly fascinating for me, would you say that your quest to really explore the region at this level is something that's connected to a generational kind of quest, having been born in the early 1980s. You know, you write that you were in a sense conceived when martial law was declared in Poland. So I assume you were born in 1982, like myself. So yeah. Therefore, I wanted to ask you a bit about that as well.
That's a great question. I did a lot of traveling for the book, although interrupted by the pandemic, but not fatally. I did the first kind of wave of traveling 2018, 2019. After the pandemic intervened, and I started again in 21-22. And before that, I lived in Poland for quite some time. And what I loved about those travels is that, especially it's maybe completely only true of Eastern Europe, but I think it's more true of Eastern Europe than Western Europe, certainly, is that you can stumble onto things that are really forgotten, that are not part of the kind of commemorative impulse and the museological impulse, and they aren't kind of cocooned in what this means and this is preserved, that are kind of in, you know, kind of find history in the raw, often because they're orphaned objects, that they belong to a people or a tradition that is no longer dominant or important. So there are the Armenian churches of Transylvania, that community has really shrunk and vanished, and they're both once powerful and wealthy and had money to import monks from Venice and to build on a large scale. And I honestly stumbled onto this Armenian cathedral at the middle of nowhere, but a very small village now that also has a Transylvanian prince's palace, which is also abandoned, full of, you know, old furniture, junk, part of it's a garage. And you find stuff like that in the Polish woods. There's a Belarusian prophet in the 30s, and stories locally famous and otherwise unwritten and not academically barely studied, but just a fascinating story from the 30s. And the remains of that are just in the woods. Someone at some point put a commemorative stone next to it, but otherwise it's just a decaying farmhouse in this Belarusian enclave of Poland that has very little kind of cultural material support from the state or from the outside world. It's very much kind of left to its own devices. And you find that you go down to that level, when you leave the capital's cities, especially go deep in the countryside, that Eastern Europe stops being a mosaic of states and of nations, and this mosaic of much smaller units of local memory, of things that are important on a very local, sometimes a micro-local level. Sometimes they were important and they aren't important any longer. Sometimes they're important. The shrine in Babadag, which is a place Stashuk, Andrzej Stashuk made kind of famous, and I went for slightly different reasons. There's a kind of official shrine that the Turkish government has rebuilt a little bit. And then up on the mountain, it's really a hill, but there it's a mountain, and the woods, and the oak woods, there's a local Sufi shrine that I think only people within that, you know, like a small watershed, like a 30-mile watershed, know about and care about and have created a mythology around. Although where it begins, people aren't sure. But you get at that level, you get this mosaic of micro traditions, micro communities, and micro patriotisms of the important wood, important shrine, that kind of comes back to that, to deeper level of belief and community organization. And sometimes you're getting traces of things that have just materially vanished. A lot of the Jewish past in Poland, a lot of it's still there, and across Eastern Europe. Although sometimes there were surprises for me, you know, going to Southern Hungary, going to Northern, and it used to be the Bacska, the synagogues in Szeged and in Novi Sad and Subotica are these incredible cathedrals. I mean, they're Jewish cathedrals. They're from the turn of the 19th century, on a scale and a lavishness and a beauty unlike anything in Poland, anything surviving in Poland, and that incredible confidence and self-regard of the Jewish communities of the turn of the fin de siècle Hungary, which you see in these just amazing structures, which aren't abandoned, but also don't have, you know, don't fulfill, they aren't central the way they once were. That community, you know, it's almost, you know, there's a small community and a huge, beautiful synagogue. For me, coming from like a experience of Poland, where there'd be tiny ruined synagogues that have been used to store fertilizer or you know, just abandoned or used to store salt, road salt, or the roof had caved in for years, you know, these really neglected buildings, to come to this completely reversal was such a surprise. I had no idea. I kind of somehow, you know, had no idea. And you step in across 100 years in a moment to experience, you know, to imagine that Hungarian Jewish world, that Hungarian, now Serbian Jewish world. So you just find all these surprises and all these local variations. As to the generational question, that's interesting. I actually am not sure. I wonder, I think there's a definite generational component, but I wonder which generation. Sometimes I think, am I the youngest of a generation that started in the late 60s? Am I on the young end of that generation of, you know, those young reporters that's talking about, Hannah Kral students, like Mariusz Stygiel, Krzysztof Barka? They're all, I think, like late, you know, born late 60s, early 70s, and started this project of going back into the past in the late 90s, early 2000s. And am I at the tail end of that, or am I in the young, you know, the oldest of a generation born in the 80s, who were kind of the last to see communism, the last to see state socialism, and had the last experience of the grandparents of the pre-World War II, almost sometimes pre-World War I generation? Because I had that, you know, the relatives who could talk about maybe not life under the Tsar, but life in the 20s, life in the 30s, the life of the pre-Shoah Jewish world, the pre-World War II Poland and Lithuania, and you got the last glimpse, like kind of last oral, direct oral contact. And they had that oral contact with the world before World War I. And I had that, and they all died when I was in my teens. And so you have the feeling that you're the last oral, not witness, but hearer of those stories. So there's a sense of that starting a generation. And I'm wondering what's coming, the people who are younger than us, born with no memory of the 80s, no memory of, or with their first memories being the transition, will they be writing in a different way? Is that, they're definitely Polish writers born in the early 80s. I think I'm a little similar to the youngest writers, like Krzysztof Szabłowski. But I'm kind of waiting to see what the Małgorzata Reimer is younger, and there is a wonderful journalist and writer. Will we form a generation, you know, starting in 1980 and going younger than that? I think it's a little too early to tell.
No, that's right. That's really an open question. And thank you so much for those reflections. I should briefly mention that I actually put a picture of the Subotica synagogue on the cover of my first English language book. Oh, it's the first time I saw it. I couldn't believe how wonderful it was, and what an amazing building, sort of abandoned.
It's incredible. I got up to, I took a bus across the border from Hungary, went to Subotica, and then I actually knew there was a synagogue there, but its scale and its kind of magnificence is so overwhelming, so much beyond what even a photograph does. I totally understand why you use that for a cover item. It is, and anyone who's listening, visit if you can. Yeah, there in Novi Sad.
Absolutely. And I was lucky that, you know, Rudolf Klein, who's one of the major authorities on synagogue architecture in the region, gave me one of his photos. But again, that's just fabulous. The detail. Now, I wanted to ask you also about your intended audience, because I suppose that's something that might also connect us quite a lot, which is that we are sort of both Western, Eastern Europeans, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you with a very strong Polish and Polish-Jewish background, me, somebody who comes from originally from Hungary and, you know, lives now in the Netherlands, and you're in a sense a US-based writer, somebody who studied there, somebody who's also very active in the US media. So I wanted to ask you a bit about the intended audience for this book and how that might have shaped what and how you have written. Right, this is of course in the English language, it's by a major publisher, it's widely distributed, it's already been widely read and received really well, I should add. And it's a book that aims to, I would say, convey a sense of fascination, a sense of wonder that a dedicated exploration of Eastern Europe can bring, even as you clearly warn against the undue nostalgia or any kind of romanticization. You also place a clear emphasis on prophecies, on mysteries, even on absurdities, right, when interpreting this very rich history. So would you say that you are in the end trying to make a Western audience grasp Eastern Europe better in a more kind of substantial and more adequate way? And if so, are there perhaps specific stereotypes or misunderstandings that you were trying to address and maybe even correct in a way? And conversely, could I also ask, you know, what do you expect readers who are living in or who are from Eastern Europe, like myself, what do you expect them to make of your depictions and of your arguments?
It's another great question. I do think that the initial that is written more towards a Western audience than Eastern, and a Western audience that has an interest in the area, maybe a connection, but not a deep knowledge of it. It is meant to be something that, you know, opens the door and leads people to other travels and other books. And I think that ideally people read it and they start reading Prabal or Banfi, start getting into the fiction and the history, that this is a start. And if it is trying to dispel stereotypes, and actually teaching American college students, you do encounter quite a bit of stereotypes, but somewhat vague ones. If there's one overwhelming stereotype, it's that Eastern Europe doesn't quite fully exist in the mental map of, I think, some Americans and some Western, I think it's true in Britain and Western Europe a little less, but to a certain degree, that there is a clear mental image of Spain, of Italy, and Germany, and France. And then going east, it gets much vaguer, it's less defined. The smaller the country, the less context there is. And there's a kind of a general sense of grayness, drabness, tragedy, sadness. I mean, I have this remark from a friend who teaches at a different university, teaches a very kind of renowned scholar of East Prussia and Poland, but had a student ask him once, you know, is it true that in Eastern Europe, no one ever laughs? As like a genuine question. It's like, well, that's ridiculous. That's absurd. But you get that sense of, you know, something like a gray place. People don't laugh, of seriousness, of economic underdevelopment. And, you know, there are stereotypes within that of the Balkans as some way criminal. But I think a lot of it is actually just a question mark on the mental map. And literally, if you give people a map exam, they don't know where a lot of these countries are, unfortunately. So if I'm trying to dispel an idea of overwhelming gloom on one hand, and the other hand, trying to make things more specific, more tangible. So that's why I try to do as much storytelling at this level of individuals, of people, because that is more vivid and that is more tangible. And at this level of introducing people, I think it's effective. I am trying to introduce and to say, this is worth looking at, this is worth thinking about, this is worth experiencing and traveling to, and it's an incredibly culturally vibrant and interesting place with a past that's often tragic, but not only tragic. So that, and you know, the reader, and that's where it gets tricky coming to an Eastern European reader, because I have to leave out and I can't assume knowledge almost of anything you find with, like, I had an editor ask me, you know, what is a Cossack? And I'm like, well, I know if you grew up on Polish fiction and Polish kind of like in, you know, Eastern Europe, it's like, well, let me tell you about Bachmann. I mean, you know, you start from being very way too specific. But that level of question of like, well, who was Franz Joseph? You know, what is a Habsburg? Who were the Habsburgs? You can't, a lot of things that are just part of the fabric of living in Eastern Europe and people who are very famous. Like I mentioned Piłsudski in a paragraph, and I had someone just ask me, I've never heard this name. I don't know who that is. So people who are very famous in Eastern Europe in different countries, all of that has to be contextualized and explained to a Western audience. I hope that an Eastern audience, even though there's a lot of things that, you know, are not, no one will be surprised to like read what the Habsburg Empire was or what the Russian Empire was, or very few people will be. So there's an amount of just plain historical statement that won't be new, but that an Eastern European reader will see some unexpected commonalities across the region. Because as you said, I think Eastern European history, you know, Polish history is about Poland, Czech history is about Czechia or Czechoslovakia, Hungary, you know, it's siloed into areas. And thinking regionally is something we don't do very often. And so I, you know, that was an experience of writing the book of discovering commonalities I didn't expect at all, like with Albania, which is almost as far as you can get, like from a Polish experience, it's as far as you can get geographically. It's a very different country, economically, culturally, religiously. And there were things that were just shockingly, like just like my, you know, things that people did on an intimate level under Sojourns that took me back right to my grandmother, like the collecting of packaging, collecting of bits and pieces of Western memorabilia and packaging. I'm like, oh, well, my grandmother did that. And parallels and also actual shared experiences that run right through the region across very, very different countries. But there were types of experience and types of insecurity, types of tragedy, types of desire, types of craving for the West. And I think that's a somewhat unknown. I think that regional perspective, you know, someone, there's a book waiting to be written for Americans about, well, the Western Hemisphere, I think. We don't think about North America as a real unit. We don't think about the Americas as a unit ever, honestly. It's all American history. But to think regionally, all of us need to discover commonalities that you didn't suspect. So I hope there's some of that and some of that local tradition, local story that will be fresh for Eastern European readers. But the initial audience is the real, you know, American or Western European reader who knows something, knows that Franz Joseph was someone, knows that, you know, there was a Russian Empire, but needs most of the details filled out, needs the map sketched in. And so this is that initial, you know, an open, you know, a door opening, not a door closing. That's how I try to do it.
Fascinating. Now, we started by talking about history writing and the approaches, and I wanted to return to that a bit in closing, but also to then discuss where you end the book. Now, we mentioned, you know, approaches to the imperial history. Peter Judson's name may stand for this approach these days. John Connolly for the national approach, somebody who you have worked with at Berkeley, is, I think, very prominent in this respect as well. And I see your book, honestly, as a significant attempt to depict Eastern Europe that actually existed alongside the structures that were imposed by empires, but also the Eastern Europe that existed sort of independently of all those hopes and all those tragedies, in a sense, that were also fostered then by nationalism. And you, I think, put a very clear emphasis, and I must say I greatly appreciate that, on nonconformists and on heterodox ideas, right? But you also titled the book Goodbye Eastern Europe, right? Referencing a place that has almost entirely disappeared by now. That's also something you, of course, discuss very early on in the book. And then you say towards the end that, in a sense, Eastern Europe today suffers from what you might call a surfeit of history, but actually it seems to possess really few useful narratives. So having said all that, I wanted to ask, you know, would you say that the Eastern Europe you have encountered in your lifetime and encountered in recent years, also having traveled around so extensively and thought about this region, would you say that this is in some sense still that kind of benignly neglected open space where nonconformism and heterodox ideas may flourish? And How do you view the chances of, you know, what you, I think, really beautifully call ramshackle utopias towards the end of the book? How do you see the chances of such utopias being developed here now in the 21st century?
That's a fascinating question. A real point for reflection. I do think that the world, you know, set out in those initial like eight chapters is completely gone. You can find traces of it, but that utopia I'm writing about of very different traditions, very different religious, social, ethnic traditions living very close together. You can find traces of it in places like, you know, the Transylvania villages are very much like in heaven now by Gabor Roma, used to be German, places in Albania, places like deep at the, you know, in deep Eastern Europe, you find bits of it. But it's really the 20th century took such a punishment, has destroyed so much of it, that pre-modern world is in traces and relics. And I kind of feel that I'm a little bit, as a Polish, you know, that Polish Jewish world is also, there are Polish Jews everywhere, but very few in Poland. I think I'm related to half of them. That feeling of things being whittled down to relics. But the wider idea of heterodoxy, that's true, I think, hopefully, of it being a somewhat less managed space, of there being openness, a possibility in Eastern Europe. I think that's true for in different ways. More maybe potential than realized. But there is something, I don't want to, you know, you can fall easily into the trap of old Europe versus young Europe. There's a little bit of truth to that. There's a way that things culturally and institutionally and governmentally can have calcify over decades in the West, that there's room for experimentation in Eastern Europe. If you think about, I'll just take two spots. Estonia has such an experimental 21st century approach to governance, and they're really innovating on the level of how they administer and how they use the internet and how they use voting and how they organize things. And on the totally opposite end of Eastern Europe, Albania, which is in tough shape economically, tough shape politically in some ways, extremely vibrant, I think, culturally, going there, incredible ideas, environments in how they're managing cultural memory and how they're doing museums and local museums, and great art, great artists, incredible scene. There's a biennial recently in Kosovo that had amazing work, and maybe one of the most exciting places for painting, sculpture, urban renewal, urban, you know, the president's a son of a sculptor and an artist, installation work, just really interesting things coming out of Albania. So on opposite ends of Eastern Europe, you have room to create and to innovate. There is potential. And there is also across the area, there is that, you know, that idea of history versus narrative. There's this constant contestation over what the past was and what it should be going forward. And it's uncomfortable some of the time, but very dynamic. You know, you have countries that are only 30 years old, a bunch of them, not all of them, but, you know, in between, or revived in the past 30 years. And countries that still have that, you know, you have incredibly settled historiographies in some of Western Europe. You have just the debates over the French Revolution or so that have gone through so many iterations. You have a lot of fresh history to be written and fresh history that's being written. And those arguments are very hot and very fresh. So incredible, I think, historiographical innovation coming out of, like, actually, honestly, Hungary and Poland for me. But I think more is coming. There's so much left to be studied and left to be probed in the archives of Romania, Bulgaria, across the Balkans, across the whole area. So there's a lot more space to innovate. So I hope there's, and I think that's why with Istvan Rev and some of the historiography is so creative, that's about Eastern Europe, and the approaches, I think, are so diverse. And the work's really interesting. So hopefully, you know, I hope that 1,000 heterotopias bloom across the region. I'm not sure that might be a little too hopeful, but it's a possibility.
Thank you so much for that fascinating response and for the entire conversation today, Jacob.
Thank you. Wonderful questions. It's been great to be with you today.
The pleasure has been all mine. I have been discussing with Jacob Michanowski today, whose original and captivating new book is out under the title Goodbye Eastern Europe, An Intimate History of a Divided Land. I hope you have enjoyed our conversation apropos this major history book. Until the next conversation here at the Review of Democracy.